Okay. I'm sure most of you have Mr. Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex. I think everybody has gotten that. Some haven't. Who does not have this book? Just a few. I do have a few extra copies, I believe, at home, and there may be one or two in the library at church, and you might check it out, because for next week's Bible study, you'll have to use this, and I would like for you to review it. I'd like for you to review most of the chapters here, but in particular, I'd like for you to review the chapters on the anatomical parts of sex, the different parts of the body, the different technical terms, because we will be referring to those in the next Bible study, which will be on sex technique in marriage. And to know what we're talking about, you will have to be familiar with some of the terms, and there are diagrams also and illustrations for you in the book, I believe. I'm thumbing through it now. I'm pretty sure they are here. Where are they? Somewhere they are there, though. But thumb through that, study the terms, get to know your own body in that way, because we will refer to it next week. This week, of course, we're going to be going again now through the Song of Songs, and we will cover chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8. And I would like, though, before we do, to go back, because I know there are some here who weren't here last time, and give a bit of review of the first four chapters, and go over again chapter 4, The Wedding Night. I see they brought me a lectern, but I don't think I can use that. I don't think I'd be able to see. I'm a little taller than the average bear. And to stand here and try and look down would be almost impossible for me, although I could see you better, and you could see me, but I wouldn't see what I was reading. So we all tangle up here, too. Watch my step. As mentioned before, I'll go over some of the basic principles to understanding the Song of Solomon. As I have called it, it is a song for lovers. This book of Scripture is about love, it is about romance, it is about sex, it is about courtship, and it is about marriage. And we'll see tonight, it is also about maturing marriage. And marriage ought to get better. You know, I compared the romance, the marriage, and the sex should be approached like a bottle of priceless fine wine. And you know, the older wine gets, the more valuable it gets. And if it's really good wine, and it's bottled properly, it will taste even better. Now, I guess some people's marriages is somewhat like old wine, but wine that hasn't been prepared right and bottled right, and it turns to vinegar. But God never intended wine, as it gets older, to turn to vinegar. It was supposed to get mellower. And that's how God intends your marriage to be. And this is how we'll see this marriage progressing tonight. The three main characters, as we stated last week, is Solomon, his Shulamite bride, and God. Because God is the designer of man and woman, he is the designer of sex and marriage. Now, the principles we discussed last time to understanding the book are these. We have to understand that many Bible scholars try and hide the true meaning of the Song of Songs. They try to spiritualize it away and try to allegorize it away and try to hide the true meaning, because it was meant as a manual to husbands and wives on romance and sex. Also remember that older translations also tend to hide. The King James Version, is, you know, in particular, was written in 1611 after the influence of Queen Victoria. That's where the term Victorian comes from. She was very, very prudish when it comes to sex and to marriage. And I think she even wrote a letter to her daughter stating that you really ought not to do it, but sometimes you have to give in to these animalistic drives. And that's the way she looked at it. It's totally animalistic when God meant it to be something very beautiful. Thirdly, realize the book is inspired in the romantic language and colloquialisms of the day. We talked about in one instance how it says he told her hair was like, looked like to him, like, you know, a herd of sheep coming off Mount Gilead. Now that wouldn't, as we talked about, wouldn't be very complimentary if we use that towards our mate today. But then they had a picture of a very beautiful scene of the sheep just sort of flowing down off the mountain, and it was like her hair, and it was very beautiful. So realize that the book is written, it just is abounding with poetic imagery. Figures of speech are used here to capture the emotional intent of Solomon and the Shulamite bride. Simple words could not express their love. And in the same way we have love songs today, and we say, you know, your love is sweeter than honey. You know, they too spoke on those terms to capture the true emotion. So to understand, you have to associate the emotionalism to the metaphor that is given in their lives and in the story. By way of review, and I don't want to go through the whole book again, but by way of review, some of you can get the tape. I think Richard has a few that he will be producing of the first Bible study. But a quick review, chapter 1, verse 2 through 11, is about her first days in the palace. The first time she was taken from the vineyards in the field into the palace. It is about how she was, especially in verses 5 through 6, how self-conscious she was about herself because she was tanned and scorched from the sun from working in the fields, where all the other palace girls were pampered and well taken care of. She longs for him during that time, and he spends the rest of the chapter praising her and reassuring her that she is beautiful despite her background of being a country girl. Working out in the fields, he reassures her and makes her feel really at home there in the palace. Chapter 2, he continues his praise, and then she begins to praise him. And the setting there basically is that they're out in the country. Chapter 3, verse 1 through 4, talks about her anxiousness and her anxiety the night before the wedding, how she couldn't sleep, how she perhaps had a dream or nightmare where she lost him, and she went about the streets asking the police, the watchman, where she was, and could they help her, and she finally found them and took him home, to her home, which was her place of security. And then verse 6 through 11 in chapter 3, we see the wedding procession. And we see in their culture that the emphasis was not placed upon the bride, but the emphasis was placed upon the man, the king. And it shows the quality of the procession. We see him in his couch inlaid with gold and silver, showing the quality of the marriage. We see him surrounded by 60 of his mightiest men with their swords and shields, symbolic of the fact that he had the ability to provide for her and to protect her, just as every husband does. And that's why the emphasis was put on the man, because he is key to the relationship. He really is. As I've said time in and time out, that a man can shape and make his woman what he wants her to be. And men, your wives are a result of you. Now, I know that we're all individuals. That's true. I don't mean to take that away. Your wife is an individual, so don't get upset, wives. If I come across and make it sound that you're just a puppet on a string, you're not. But your husband has a great deal of influence upon you. Jesus Christ talked about that fact in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. He talked about that Christ was the head of the church, just like the husband was the head of the wife, and how that Christ was the Savior of the body. He talked about the fact that that he would clean up the church, that it would be without spot, wrinkle, or blemish. The same holds true as the responsibility of the husband. How he leads and loves his wife will be how she will come out. And we've seen that last week, how he praised her, how he built her up, how he made her feel secure. And we're going to further see more of the leadership. I think, though, that wedding night is so important, I do want to go through it again. Again, I'm not going to be reading from the King James. I'm going to be reading from the New American Standard Version. I want to go to the wedding night again because there is a comparison that we must make as we see their love maturing. Let's see it burgeoning now in chapter 4 again. Some of this will be review for some of you who were here last week. For others, this will be helpful. Verse 1 of chapter 4, it says, "Behold," this is Solomon speaking, "behold, you are beautiful, my darling. Behold, you are beautiful." So here on the wedding night, he verbalizes his love for her. He tells her how beautiful she is. And as I said, husbands, wives never get tired of hearing that. They never get tired of hearing that. To them, it sounds as good 30 years down the road as it did that first time you met her and saw her and praised her. Your eyes are doves from behind your veil, bright and alert, in other words. Your hair is like a flock of goats which descend from Mount Gilead. Again, that's just an analogy of looking at her hair and how captivating it was. It appeared to him, as he had seen many times in the evening in the setting sun, as the sheep coming down, the goats coming down off Mount Gilead, in just a flowing stream. That's how her hair looked to him. And I might add that, and I don't mean to make anybody feel uncomfortable about it, but I think most of the men would agree, that long hair is very beautiful to a man. Now, I see many silver-haired women there. I think that's an exception. I think once a woman's hair, now this is Earl Williams speaking, okay? This is off the record. I think once a woman's hair gets gray and silver and salt and pepper-ish, it doesn't quite look as well long. But I think for a young woman, there's nothing more beautiful than a woman with long, flowing hair. And I think most men would agree. How many men agree with that? You better. I can't have my philosophies go down and lose credibility. I'll pay you afterwards. Nevertheless, it is. But, you know, there are different hairstyles. And if your hairstyle and you're young and it's short, that's up to you. That's just how you want to wear it. That's beautiful. That's fine. But I just say, you know, it is beautiful. And some women just aren't able to grow long hair. And that's fine, too. But husbands, you know, praise your wife. If your wife's hair is short, you know, if it's medium range, if it's long, praise her for it. And wives, whatever length your hair is, take care of it. Take good care of it. And make it as attractive as possible to your husbands to engender those kind of praises. You can say, well, my husband never praises me about my hair. Why don't you ask him? Why don't you ask him this? Honey, and have you ever done it? You answer that in your own mind. How do you like my hair? I won't ask for a show of hands, but I wonder how many wives have ever asked their husbands how they like them to wear their hair. You might say, well, I'm my own person. I'm an individual. You know, well, that's fine. Okay. ERA or whatever. But, you know, we're here to get along. We're here to grow closer together. We're here to please one another. You know, it said there, didn't it, in 1 Corinthians 7, first couple of verses, it said that after marriage, that your body as a woman belongs to your husband, and husbands, your body belongs to your wife. So, you know, maybe we ought to communicate, even husbands, and say, hey, well, honey, how do you like wearing my hair? How do you like me to dress? You know, because I my wife dresses, and I don't mean this because I've got her under my thumb or on a ball and chain, and she's, you know, put her brain on a shelf and so forth. But she asked me, well, honey, you know, how do you like my hair? She asked me, you know, she won't hardly even buy a dress. And sometimes I don't have time. I say, hey, go buy it. But she wants to buy clothes and dress to please me. And I want to dress and I want to do things to please her. When it is a mutual thing like that, nobody feels cheated. She doesn't feel that I'm domineering or dominating her life. And I don't feel she is mine because it is mutual. Now, if I was just telling her everything to do, and what pleases me, and she was not also, you know, reciprocating, then it would be a one-sided thing. But it ought to be a mutual thing where you, while, you know, while you're married and so forth, that you do please one another. But let me go on. So we talked about that, her hair. In verse 2, he says, your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn sheep. Again, not such an adequate way to express love today, but then it was, which have come up from the washing. In other words, they were clean. Crest, ultra bright, whatever. Brush your teeth, people. You know, really. You know, maybe your wife doesn't respond to your kisses because you've got gold nuggets for teeth. And they weren't put there by the dentist. You know what I'm trying to say. The plaque, you know. I'm serious. I have had women tell me that. I don't like to kiss him because he's dirty. He comes in and his hands are dirty and his breath stinks. And then he wants to be affectionate, and I want to be affectionate to him, but it's a real challenge. You know, I need a gas mask too. You know, Really? So husbands, you know, if you want to, you know, be close to your wife and vice versa and have it be responsive, be clean and neat and smell good. Okay? You know, if you're coming in smelling like a quarter horse, it's not going to, you know, engender anything. Now let's go on. Anyway, all of which are paired, and not one of them is alone. So she was lucky enough to have all of her teeth. Verse 3, like a scarlet thread are your lips. Not that they were so fine, microscopic, he couldn't find them to kiss. They were like thread. No. And your mouth is lovely. He is talking again about the lines of her face, the lines of her mouth. As I said before, beauty is not necessarily so much of size. But sometimes a woman can have large features or small or medium, but it is the way that they are aligned. Just like as some men would look at a boat or a car and says, boy, that car has beautiful lines. The way they're outlined. He goes on to say, your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. In other words, her cheeks and her temples were flushed. They were reddish. They were ruddy. They were beautiful in that way. And look how much in detail. He is like an artist, like a Leonardo da Vinci of love, like great artist that is taking his time to describe. What was the word, the song? It would take, I know, a Michelangelo to paint a portrait of my love. And then even he would need the glow of dawn that paints the sky above. You know, this is what he is describing, his love. It would take a Michelangelo. Now, when you praise your wife, fellows, do you take the time and use your tongue like a brush to paint a picture of your love to her? Well, you should. And we also like to hear it, wives, from you. Like the Tower of David is your neck. Not that she had a neck like Dick Butkus. But her neck here is not being described for size. It is being described as character, built for warfare. 1,000 shields hang upon it, and all the shields of the mighty men. There in the city of Jerusalem was the Tower of David, and it was a fortress. And the neck throughout Scripture is used to describe one's character. The stiff-necked Israelites. Here we talked about the Tower of David, her neck being like that, showing her character. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. In other words, they were tender and soft. And they were inviting to be caressed, just like a baby deer. When you see a little baby deer, you want to fondle it, you want to play with it. This is what was engendered when he saw her. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. In other words, all night long he would make love to her. And she earlier wished, before they were married, that he would do that he would lie all night between her breasts. This was described in chapter 2 and verse 17. And here the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense are her breasts. And they were described with perfume because they were intoxicating to him. He was thrilled by them. And here he gives a summary of his love for her and her beauty. He says, you are altogether fair, my love, and there is no blemish in her. And here he praises her and he makes her feel very, very secure on that wedding night. Here he describes seven aspects or characteristics of her beauty, showing seven as God's number of perfection. Later we will see, as I said last time, not that she would be ranked only as a seven on the scale of beauty. She would be actually ranked as a 10. I don't know if the movie people, I doubt if they read this to get that from there. But now she's a seven in his eyes. But later on, as their love grows and matures, she will become a 10. He will use 10 characteristics of her beauty to describe her. Here, he is making her feel very secure on the wedding night. Some of you are yet not married. Let me slow down. I'm getting tongue-tied. Some who are both male and female. And on the wedding night, a woman can be very, very insecure about herself, about her body, how it will go. And here, he makes her feel very relaxed. Very comfortable, very confident with the praise. Not only should that be done on the wedding night, but it should be done all the time before a lovemaking. As I said, I call this mental foreplay. He hasn't touched her yet. He simply speaks to her. He simply praises her. Now, we all have heard of the term foreplay physically, where we fondle one another in marriage. But here, he shows the importance of mental foreplay to establish the attention, to focus one's attention on one's mate. And he does that mentally first. We want to go too fast. Love should be, again, like a fine wine that should be sipped. We want to go too fast, fellows. We must slow down and take the time to tell our wives how beautiful they are and how much they mean to us before we get into any kind of physical contact. Verse 8 of chapter 4. Now, you know, I remember the song, Make the World Go Away. But this is what he's doing for her. Through all of this praise, he's helping her to forget all of her cares, all of her fears. Again, it's important that we do that at night or whenever we're making love. First, to get our mates' minds off of the cares of the day, off of the problems. In verse 8, with me, he says to her, from Lebanon, O bride, with me from Lebanon come. Journey from the peak of Amana. Now, this was a peak on the mountain of Hermon, from the peak of Shinar and Hermon. There in Lebanon, these were prominent peaks there. Someone has jokingly said he was telling her to come away with him from one of his old, her old boyfriends named Hermon. Well, I doubt that, whether he was trying to get her mind off of Hermon. Hermon was a mountain. It wasn't an old boyfriend. But whatever her mind was on, he was trying to get it off of, you know, her homeland or where she was from, far away places like Lebanon, and bring her thoughts to him to capture them. He goes on to say, from the dens of lions and the mountains of leopards. Here, she wasn't in a lion's den or leopards, but perhaps she was fearful that first night. And the lion's den and the mountains of leopard were simply the fears that she would have in her mind that first night. And he wanted her to forget them and to concentrate on him. These were fearful places. So the purposes then of this kind of mental foreplay is to focus the thoughts and attentions totally on one's mate, to prepare one's emotions and heart to totally give to one another, which must be in sex if it's to be fulfilling and enjoyable. Each partner must surrender and give to the other. And thirdly, to prepare one's body physically. Through the mental stimulation, she was being prepared to be prepared physically. Now comes the physical foreplay and the physical stimulation. But the mental must come first. It prepares the senses. It prepares the emotions. Now we go to verse 9. You have made my heart beat fast, he continues to speak to her. Oh, he was getting excited now. My sister, my bride, and sister is an affectionate term, like we say darling or honey. Then, the affectionate term for wife and marriage was sister. You have made my heart beat fast with one glance of your eyes. As I said, you know, use eye contact in marriage to turn one another on, to inspire feelings of love, to glance into your mate's eyes, to lock in and to hold it and to smile. That can really turn them on. So even before he puts his hands on her, there's even the eyes that are making the contact first. So mentally, visually, and sex is visual, very, very visual in nature, in orientation. With one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace, how beautiful are your caresses, my sister, my bride. How much better are your caresses than wine. As I said, nice girls do too. Bad girls do, we've heard. But nice girls do too. And what I'm trying to say is, it is not wrong. It is right. It should be encouraged for the wife to be a bit aggressive in the sexual relationship. Here he was praising her for her caresses, and it was not a handshake, believe me. It was not. It was far more intimate than that. And he said to him, boy, that really turned him on. He said, that's much better than wine to me. And she wasn't afraid to do that. She wasn't sort of inhibited. And we must, you know, let's face it. I wasn't taught right about sex. And I doubt whether very few of you were here. And we're here to learn and to change. And to get rid of some of the negative, whether it's on the liberal side or the conservative side, things that we have in our minds about sex, the inhibitions, the feelings that it's something dirty and nasty. God would not have had it inspired in His Word if it were. It is something clean and beautiful. It is Satan who perverts everything, even sex, for us to look at it as something taboo. And if we don't look at it as something taboo, we pervert it. We overuse it. We use it out of the context of marriage. We go from, you know, whoredoms to homosexuality to bestiality. So from one end of the pendulum to the other, Satan gets us going. But God looked at it as something beautiful and clean, as we'll see in a moment. He goes on to say, how much better are your caresses than wine, and the fragrance of your perfumes than any spice. She smelled good, and that's important, ladies. And I think ladies are much more aware of that than husbands. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. He wasn't afraid to kiss her. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. In other words, he said, hey, look. And God is saying, it is not wrong for us in marriage to enjoy one another's bodies. As I said, the French did not come up with French kissing. This was there thousands of years before the French ever became famous for it. And we need to remove some of our inhibitions between ourselves in marriage, between husbands and wives. I just want to take one departure here quickly. In Hebrews, the 13th chapter, I'll be reading from the King James Version. I intended to read this last week but failed to. Hebrews 13. In verse 4, it says, marriage, Paul said, is honorable in all, in every aspect of the relationship between the man and the woman, and the bed undefiled. In other words, what you and your wife do in the bed between yourselves is not a sin. It is undefiled. It is unperverted. It is your garden, as he'll describe it, to imbibe and to enjoy. But whoremongers, see the wrong use, whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge. God hates it used in an inordinate way, but he puts his full honor and blessing upon it within the context of marriage. So just wanted to read that here as we describe how they were enjoying one another. I know I even had one couple one time, or one lady, her husband was not in the church, but she was. And she, I guess, had never, this is either somebody I talked to, or maybe it was another minister I was talking to, but this case existed. She had never let him kiss her, or vice versa, this way. French kissing, as he's describing, honey and milk are under your tongue. You know, it was just sort of on the lips, and that was it. Because she just felt it was wrong. And just to show you, how we can, say, well, hey, even in marriage, we can't do this. And again, God said the bed is undefiled. Verse 12 now. Now he praises her virginity. They are touching, but he is continuing now. After the physical foreplay has begun now, he continues the mental foreplay, the verbal foreplay. He says, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. He praises her now for her virginity. I want to stop and comment on that, because I know that none of us were reared in the church, and some of those who were and are, don't always do right. And by reading this, I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable or feel, say, boy, I wish I had of, done it that way, and I didn't, and, I really feel depressed and dejected because, I didn't, follow this, and I wasn't this way at marriage. Well, it sort of reminds me of the woman who came to Jesus Christ at the well, since he'll describe wells here. And he was standing there at the well, and she came, and she wanted some water. And she had four or five husbands, and the man she was living with now wasn't her husband. She was committing adultery. And he says, if you knew I could give you waters, I'm paraphrasing now, that you would never thirst anymore. And he talked about her marriage situation and her present situation of adultery. And he said to her, in essence, what he told another woman, to go and sin no more. He says, the man you're living with now isn't your husband. That woman heeded. And from that point on began the springtime of that woman's life. She went and changed. You can't do anything about the past, but you can do an awful lot about the future. And God can heal and God can forgive. And just because maybe we didn't do things right in the past doesn't mean all is lost. Doesn't mean from this point on and from God's point of forgiveness, we can't go on in the future and be that way and be a garden lot if you're not married now. Or if you are married, to enjoy your marriage in the proper context. And we need to look at it that way. You know, the Scripture says in Christ all things are new. Even our sins and things that we've done sexually that are wrong in the past. So I don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. God can forgive all. And we can certainly start anew. And I just wanted to state that in case anybody, because I know what life is. And, I know where we all live. And we need to understand that. So a garden locked in verse 12. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. So he praises her for her virginity and for her character. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are a paradise of pomegranates with excellent fruit, henna blossoms and nard plants. Her body, as he describes it, was as beautiful and as fruitful as a garden, heretofore locked and preserved. Nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and olives, with all the choicest spices, a garden fountain. He says, not only a garden fountain is it, he increases the intensity now, a wellspring of water. And not only a wellspring of water, streams flowing from Lebanon. So here he shows in three phrases, hey, you're like a fountain. No, you're better than a fountain. You're like a fountain in a garden that takes care of a whole garden. No, you're even better than that. You are a well of living water. You're able to take care of many gardens. No, you're better than that. You're like the streams that flow down from Lebanon. That's how intense he was and how appreciative he was of her love and her dedication, her saving herself, and of her body. That's how he was to be satisfied. He was saying, hey, look, your body is able to satisfy me like a fountain. No, more than a fountain. Like a fountain that takes care of a whole garden. No, more than that. Like a well that takes care of many gardens. No, like a whole river flowing is your love. And I will never thirst, and I will never have to go out for other waters. Solomon did say in Proverbs, he told the young men, drink water out of your own cisterns. In other words, from your wife, and not from another. So that's what he's describing. Now, she speaks in verse 16 to him. After he has praised her, she's prepared, she's confident, she's in love. Awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south. She now invites him to take her. Blow upon my garden and let its spices flow forth. May my beloved come to his garden and eat its excellent fruit. Now the garden, I was going to say here, she wants him to enjoy all of it, nothing held back. And she gives herself here, this is what this is describing, she's giving herself totally to him that he may come and enjoy. Now in verse 1 of chapter 5, she says to the, or he says to her, after he comes into her now, after the marriage now, or in the process, shall I say, even in the process as the marriage is being consummated, as they're coming together in sexual intercourse, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb with honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. So now he is describing as they're coming to perhaps the climax of the intercourse here. And then it goes on to say a mysterious third voice comes in. And this is the voice of God. As I said, this could not, in my estimation of things, be the other ladies of the palace. In my estimation, looking at and analyzing it, this couldn't be anybody else. This couldn't be the best man or the bridesmaid. I mean, who would, in the midst of the night, while you're at your closest time of intimacy, would be standing there, you know, commenting on it? I mean, that's just unheard of. Those kind of friends, as I said last time, you don't need around at that time. Who else in such an intimate situation could really be there and say these words if it were not God who created and made sex and marriage to be beautiful? And the rest of the verse says, eat, O loved ones, drink and be drunk. Just enjoy it to the full. You know, this is one time you can apply the term, if it feels good, do it. Now, they say that in society, but you shouldn't follow that at all times. But in marriage, if it feels good in this case, do it. He says, eat, O loved ones, drink and be drunk. Now, I know that's going to engender some questions that we're going to handle later. What do you mean, if it feels good, do it? We'll get into some of that next week. But anyway, eat, O loved ones, drink and be drunk, O lovers. God says, go to it, enjoy it, get drunk with it. Have as much as you want, O lovers. In other words, he comes in, the sex act here, this wedding night in marriage, and says, it is blessed, it is honorable, it is holy, it is good. I described last time how that God, I think it was, where, I didn't bring those notes or did it. Probably my case. Deuteronomy 6:5 was it? Where it says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and all of your might, is the same term, same Hebrew word for love. Let me find it. Da-da-da-da. Yes, Hebrews, not Hebrews, but Deuteronomy 6:5. It says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your soul and with all of your heart. And the word love here in Hebrew is A-H-A-V-A. Now, throughout the Song of Solomon, when it says love, like in Song of Solomon 7:6, it is the same word, A-H-A-V-A-H. In other words, for the same intensity that in marriage we love one another, romantically, mentally, sexually, with that same intensity, God wants us to worship Him and serve Him, and vice versa, with that same intensity. So, that's just an interesting parallel insight that I wanted to bring you. Now, let's go on. Now, we have had the courtship. We have the marriage. We have the consummation of the marriage on the wedding night. Perhaps we could end the story there, chapter 5 and verse 1, and write at the end the scenario, they lived happily ever after. That would be beautiful. That would be a beautiful way to end the movie, right? But we're not in a movie. We're in reality. We're in life. I had one individual, in fact, a couple come up to me after last time and said, you know, boy, you know, all that's beautiful and all that's good that you said, but you know, I'm not King Solomon and my wife is not the Shulamith. You know, they were perfect. Sure, it was easy for her to respect him and admire him because he was a great king. And the wives could say, or some might say, well, sure, Solomon could say all those things about her because she was a beautiful maiden, and I'm not. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And you are the king of your homes, men. And wives, you are the queen of your homes and your kingdom. And you ought to look at one another that way. And if you think that they were perfect, they weren't. They weren't. What God is presenting here is probably one of the most beautiful romances that have ever existed. Though Solomon had 1,000 wives and more, this one was the one that was special. And your mate ought to be special to you. And they made mistakes, and we're going to see that they did not live right away, happily ever after. They had some bumpy roads. You know, I've heard marriage described when it is first consummated, when people first get married, the first year or two. Described like two porcupines in Alaska, set out there in the snow and ice. And they got to grow close to one another to keep warm. But when they come close to one another, they stick one another. You know, get away. You know, they have problems adjusting. They get cold again, they come together for a while, and the stickers hurt. You know, get away. And they have problems. Until they realize that if they're going to survive, they've got to learn to adjust. To get those stickers, whatever you call those spears they got on them, you know, where they can come in between one another and they can adjust to stay together and to survive. And sometimes marriage, those first few years can be rough that way. And Solomon and the Shulamith girl here did have some of those problems. Did have some of those problems. Not long after they were married. I don't know how long. It could be up to a year. Maybe it was only a month. Something happened. Now, let's look at that in chapter 5. Will it end in disaster or will they live happily ever after? Chapter 5, you know, it says, rainy days and Mondays always get me down. Remember that song? Well, Blue Monday was about to hit here. in the evening time. Usually it's in the morning. Just in the evening. Let's call it a Monday for sake of interest here. The bride now speaks to the other ladies of the palace, to the daughters of Jerusalem there. Chapter 5, verse 2. She says she is lamenting to them. Sometimes women need to talk to other women sometime, and she does to the palace women. A little depressed here. She says, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. The sound of my beloved knocking, knock, knock, open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my hair is filled with dew, my hair with damp of the night. Here he had been out perhaps working all night. We won't say partying all night. He had been out perhaps working all night, maybe taking care of some business. All right. Now, in the palace there at Jerusalem, although they slept together, the queen had her own special room, and so did he. But they did sleep together. And after working out late at night, the dew had fallen in his hair, he comes and knocks on the door. You know, knock on the door. Honey, darling, dove, perfect one. You know, there he is. And what do you think is going to be her response? Now, we can look back and see before, when she first saw him in the palace, she thought in her mind, oh, I can hardly wait till he takes me and embraces me. Oh, that he would lie all night between my breasts till the morning comes. Remember that? How anxious she was before the wedding, the night before, how she couldn't sleep, had a dream, going out looking for him, thought she had lost him. All of that. And now look. Look at this in verse 3. Knock, knock, honey, darling, perfect one. I have put off my clothes. I have put off my tunic. Must I put it on again? Do I got to get up out of bed? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again to get to the door? Now, wait a minute. Is this the same girl? Couldn't hardly wait, couldn't hardly contain herself about him. Now he knocks on the door and she doesn't want to get out of bed. She doesn't want to take her rollers down. She doesn't want to soil her dainty feet to go to the door. Huh? I think this is a sure sign, a case of indifference. In fact, I think indifference is worse than hate. Because if you hate somebody, at least you think enough of them to hate them. Right? But apathy and indifference could be in some words described worse than hate because you don't even think about them. Your response is a yawn. You know, that really turns you on. Now, I'm sure none of you wives have ever, as your husbands have knocked, whether at the door or at the bed, given him a yawn. I'm sure you haven't. But just in case you did, maybe there's a lesson we could learn here. And look. Look at this. Look at this by comparison. Her indifference. But look at his intensity of love. It hasn't waned any. How does he call her? Never has he used in such staccato terms, in such an organization of words, the intensity of his love, where he says, open to me, my sister. Intensity. My darling. Intensity. My dove. My perfect one. He's still praising her. His heart is still aflame with love towards her. But she has only indifference and apathy now. Whereas before, she couldn't wait. Like, you know, we described here all those other times. She couldn't wait to love him. Now, she is apathetic. Now, what is his going to be his response? Is he going to say, open this door, you so-and-so? What do you mean you're tired? What do you mean you've got a headache? Huh? What do you mean you want to saw your little toesies? You better get up and open that door. Was that his response? How would he handle this? Look and see here in verse, where I was in verse 3. I'll read verse 3. I put off my tunic. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I saw them again? My beloved withdrew his hand from the door. He just left. Didn't call any names. Didn't threaten her. He just left. Now, how many of us men could handle it that way? To just leave. He knew he couldn't demand her love. And you can. I guess you can. I guess you could make her love you. But who wants that? In wisdom, he just went away. My beloved withdrew his hand from the door. And what was her response? And my feelings were aroused for him. Now look at the difference here. First, she didn't want to get out of bed. She was tired. Didn't want to take her hair down. Didn't want to do her feet. Didn't want to pull off her clothes and put them back on again. Now, he just leaves. He handles it very cool. He just leaves. She goes to the door and he's gone. And she gets aroused for him. Aren't women something? No, men are too, believe me. Right, honey? Now, if he had have responded, beating on a door with anger, demanding, she would have said, well, he's no different than any of these other old rascals running around here. I knew he was like that anyway, thinking selfishly all the time, never thinking of me, that I'm tired, that I've got my hair rolled up, that I need some rest. See, that would have engendered anger, would have engendered anger. Remember that, couples. If one mate is out of control, is in a bad attitude, it will not help them for you to face that with anger, but with calmness. With calmness. You see, the way he handled it aroused her. Where before she was apathetic towards him. He just left. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hand dripped with myrrh, and my fingers were flowing with myrrh upon the handles of the boat. Now, in their culture, a love note or a pouch of myrrh and frankincense left at the door of a beloved was like a love note or a love signal. Instead of writing a note, they would just maybe sprinkle some myrrh or frankincense, if it was an oil or the powder or whatever, would sprinkle it on the door. And when the person would open the door, they would, oh, what's that? And that would remind them of their love. You see? In fact, so he didn't get angry at all. He left quietly and left her sort of a love note or a semblance of his love. That took a lot of character from that guy. But he had had 1,000 women, so he knew how to handle them, right? So we can learn from his experience. He knew better to get angry and to respond in anger. Of course, he wrote, didn't he, that a soft answer turns away wrath. Solomon wrote that or collected it and put it in the scriptures and Proverbs. A soft answer, a soft response. So when your mate's upset and angry, I feel the best way you can handle it is not for you to get angry either. But just be calm, silent for a while, let them cool off, let them come to their senses, reassure them that you still love them, as he did by leaving the perfume there, the myrrh there as a semblance of his love. The way he handled it turned her on. Anger would have made her only more angry. And that would have been an error. And she wouldn't have been able to see her error either. Because she would have jumped on the defensive. If he'd have come accusing her and putting her down, she would have got on the defensive to defend her ego. Rather than to look inward in herself to see where she was wrong. What does Scripture say? You know, love those who hate you. Do good to those who despitefully use you. And in doing so, you will heap, you know, flaming coals of fire on her head. Well, she just had a heap of coals dumped on her head without him doing anything but loving her and being gentle and understanding. Try it sometimes, fellas. I'll show you the result here as we go along. Verse 6, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul had gone out to him when he spoke. I sought him, but did not find him. I called to him. But he did not answer me. The watchmen who go about the city found me. So she went out looking for him. She checked his room in the palace. He wasn't there. She went out looking for him. Remember before in the dream or in reality in chapter 3, the wedding night, or before the wedding day, that night, how she couldn't sleep, so anxious about the next day. Remember how she went out into the streets looking for him, and she found him and took him home. She does the same thing here, but watch what happens. She goes about the city. The watchmen find her, and they struck me. And they bruised me. They arrested her. They took my shawl from upon me, those guardians of the walls, before they helped her find him. And now they arrest her, thinking she's some evil woman of the night. And it's that way in marriage, isn't it? I've noticed that in my life. When my wife and I, when there is a disturbance, as I say, in the force and the attitude between us, things don't go right for me. It seems that, and she's the same way, you know, we'll have an argument or something won't go right, and maybe we'll leave it that way, and I'll come back home, and she'll say, honey, boy, don't leave me that way again. Well, everything went wrong today. And I'll feel the same way, too. I just am not able to be as effective. And when things aren't right between you, other things don't go right. So here she goes out and looks for him and gets arrested. Everything goes wrong. Life's falling apart for her. That's how important, and that's how what an impact, you know, love and marriage has upon us. And that's why it's so important that we have a good relationship. That's why I'm spending all this time. Because if you and your mate are getting along, if everything is right between you, you're going to have a certain amount of confidence in life. I mean, you can go out and conquer the world. But let something be wrong at home, you're just like stripped and denuded of all confidence and feeling of self-esteem. And things just don't go right. And that's how it was here with her. She got arrested until they found out who she was. She tells the women of the court, boy, that was bad. I got arrested. Now, she tells them, I adjure you, I urge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you would tell him, tell him that I am faint with love. If you find him, this is what I want you to tell him. Tell him that I am faint with love. Tell him that I still love him, in other words. That I'm sorry, that just because I didn't get up the other night, that I still love him. And she had a change of heart. She began to appreciate him a little bit more here. Now, let's go on here. Verse 9. Now the daughters of Jerusalem, the women of the palace, she's spoken to them. Now they speak back to her. And now they ask her a question to get her to think. They say, what is your beloved anyway more than any other lover? O fairest among women. They says, why are you so concerned about it? What is he more than any other husband around here? They ask her that question to get her to think, to get her to take stock and inventory of how blessed she was. And how much she really did love him. What is your beloved more than another lover that you so adjure us? So they wanted to get her to realize how blessed she was to have him. And you ought to realize that too about your mate. How blessed you are. There, you know, sure we have problems with our mates. But you ought to be blessed for the good things that they do. And we all make mistakes. Verse 10. Now she speaks back to the ladies of the palace and answers the question, what is he above any other lover, any other husband or man? And says, my beloved is dazzlingly ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. He's tall, dark, and handsome. He's the best looking guy around, if you want to know what makes him different from the other fellows around. His head is pure gold, the character there. His locks, palm leaves, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk and repossessed in their setting. His cheeks, he describes him physically, are a bed of balsam, a raised bed of spices. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. You know, all sweet lips, she calls them here. His hands are cylinders of gold set with jewels. This guy was in shape. His abdomen is like a plate of ivory covered with sapphires. You know, you see these bodybuilders, you know, their stomachs are flat and rippling with muscles like sapphires, she says he is. His legs are alabaster pillars set up on pedestals of fine gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as cedars. His mouth is sweetness. Now, she said something about his mouth before, but that was more like for his kisses. But now she says his mouth is sweetness. In other words, that's what comes out, his words, his tone, the way he handles things. Sweet things comes out of his mouth. And all of him is wonderful. Hey, there isn't a foul ounce of flesh in his body. All of him is wonderful. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. Not only is he my lover, he is my friend, she calls him. as I went through. You remember we went through those five aspects or facets of love, agape love, commitment. We went through eros, which is romantic love, and philia, which is brotherly love, and starge, the love of belonging, and epithumia, the love of sex and sex drive. She said, he's my friend too, by the way. This is the first time she's called him that. You know why she could say that now? Because of the way he had treated her. She knew not only was he her lover sexually and romantically, but that he was a friend who cared and had enough sensitivity as a man to handle it the way he did. That he was her friend to handle that situation so tenderly. He could have blown up like anybody else, but he didn't. Now her ingratitude, by the very way he handled this, is transformed into appreciation. Her attitude has changed here now. Let's go on here to verse chapter chapter 6 and verse 1. Now the women of the palace speak back to the bride. And I want to state this, that in marriage it is very, very important that you learn to forgive one another for mistakes. We're going to make them over and over again too. Forgive one another for mistakes and be willing also to accept forgiveness. It's a two-way street. Chapter 6 and verse 1. Now the daughters of Jerusalem speak to the bride. Where has your beloved gone? Do you know where he is? They ask her, O fairest among women, where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? We'll help you find him. And then she thinks a bit in her mind and she speaks back to them in verse 2. My beloved has gone to his garden. I know that's where he is. That's where he goes when he's troubled, perhaps. That's where he goes to think. And we all sort of have maybe our favorite places to go and think and collect ourselves. My beloved has gone to his garden, to beds of balsam, to pasture his flock among the gardens. She again uses the shepherd analogy to say that he is strong in character, but also gentle as a shepherd, and to gather lilies. She knows he's in his favorite garden, and he's there alone, too. She knows that. And she knows that they still belong to one another. There's no mention, well, I guess I'll go talk to a divorce lawyer. No mention of that. And she knows that her husband is like a shepherd, that he's gentle, that he's kind, and that she can go to him, and that he's there patiently waiting for her. I wonder how many of our wives know, and I speak myself as well, that when there's trouble and there's been a problem, they can always come back to us and know we won't bawl them out. Know we'll still love them. Know that we'll be like a shepherd. We'll be strong, firm, yes, but gentle as well. That's so important. You see, to make a reconciliation, parties have to feel that they can come back to one another. There has to be this climate, this atmosphere of reconciliation. Now, in verse 3, I am my beloved's. And my beloved is mine. She's telling him. She says, I know we belong together. We're together. And we belong together. The one who pastures his flock among the lilies. Now she comes. And he sees her from afar off. And the king speaks. She is met with tenderness, as we'll see in verse 4. Fair you are. Not, here comes that old nag. Wouldn't get up last night. Is that how he meets her? No, he meets her with praise. Fair you are, my darling, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, beautiful city you are, awe-inspiring as bannered host. Turn your eyes from me, for they arouse me. In other words, he says, now don't look at me now. He says, you know, I don't even want to think about sex, and you know you turn me on with that look. He says, just turn your eyes from me because, you know, I love you as a person. And sometimes wives can feel used. As Dr. Dobson said in the film that one woman wrote to him, and she says, in your book, Dr. Dobson, that's how I feel, like a prostitute. And sometimes husbands, the way we treat our wives, we can look at them and make them feel only as a sex object, as something to be used. And he didn't want her to get the impression that he wanted to make up, you know, just to go to bed with her. He says, turn your eyes away from me. They arouse me. As he says, you know, turn your eyes from me, for they arouse me. I'm not interested in sex right now. I just want to tell you that I love you. Your hair is like a flock of goats which descended from Gilead. Where do we hear that again? We heard it on the wedding night. And he uses the same phrases he used on the wedding night. Why? To let her know, to reassure her that she was still the bride he married on that wedding night. And that he still thought as much of her now, in fact, more now than that wedding night. That he wasn't sorry for that wedding night. That he wasn't sorry that he had married her. He didn't say, oh boy, I wish I had a married old so-and-so over there. No, he says, no, you're my bride. You know, your hair is same way. It reminds me of our wedding night. Your teeth are like the flock of young lambs, which have come up from the washing. Same words, all of them paired. Not that he was like a broken record, but he wanted to reassure her. Just like on the wedding night, it is still the same between us, honey. I still have a commitment to you. I still love you. And not one of them is alone. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Same things he told her the wedding night. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number, because he had thousands of them. But unique is she. You're the special one still, my dove, my perfect one. Unique is she to her mother. Just like your mother loves you, and as they say, when everybody else doesn't love you, your mother still loves you. Well, he says, hey, I love you just like your mother, but more. Pure is she to the one who bore her. So he's just reassuring her, just letting her know that she is still the girl that he married, and that she still loves. He still loves her, and that he was ready to forgive. Now let's turn over here. The daughter saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines praised her. He puts her back up on the pedestal and gives esteem to her in verse 10. Who is this looking forth like the dawn as he saw her coming, as he recollects in his mind? But this is a picture. She's already there. But this is a picture of them being reconciled together. There was a break in the relationship. Now the words that he will speak now is symbolism of them being reconciled again, coming closer and closer together as they talk and converse. Who is this looking forth like the dawn? Just at daybreak, still dark, just able to see the sun over the horizon. Fair as the moon. Now the sun comes, pure as the sun. Getting brighter. Awesome as an army of banners. So now they had come full in vision. These are visual pictures. Far off pictures and pictures that are close and with impact, like a banner with the armies here. So it's just a picture of their love coming back together. Now, while he's speaking, the bride thinks to herself, as she often does in the scripture here. She sort of thinks to herself while he is talking in verse 11. She is not speaking this. This is in her own mind. To the garden of nut trees I had gone down. She's thinking while she's speaking. Boy, you know, I went down to the garden here now to see the fresh shoots of the ravine. To see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. She said, while he's talking, I came down to the garden to see whether our love was still alive. To see whether it was possible for our love to blossom again, to flourish again, after the disturbance, after the problem. That's what she's thinking. That's why I came down here, to see if the love would bud again, if the vine would bloom. And before I was aware, while she's talking, she's getting so happy in her mind. Before I was aware, my soul set me among chariots of my people, a prince. Before she knew it, in other words, she was reconciled to him. That's she's thinking in her mind. Isn't this wonderful? I came down here to see if it was possible for our love to flourish again. And before I knew it, we were reconciled back together again. And it's interesting, he says, my soul set me among the chariots of my people, a prince. Solomon had a favorite chariot. And that chariot, when the people saw her riding in it with Solomon, they knew that they were reconciled together. Riding in Solomon's lead chariot was a symbol of reconciliation. Now the women, the daughters of Jerusalem, speak to the bride again. And they say, return, return, O Shulamite. Now they go to calling her by her maiden name again, or by her first name, or whatever it is. It's her name. But they haven't talked to her. Either Solomon nor the women of the palace have called her Shulamite for a long, long time.
And now they call her Shulamith again. They say, return, return. They're happy she's returning. Oh, Shulamith. As I told you, that Solomon's name in the Hebrew is spelled S-H-O-L-A-M. Shalom. Which means peace. That's what Solomon's name means. And that her name is simply the feminine version of Solomon. They call her by the name of Solomon. Why? Because indeed, again, they are one. That's why they go back to calling her Shulamith or Solomon. Same name, feminine and masculine. Because they are one now. They are Solomon again. They are reconciled together again. Return, return, that we may gaze upon you. Then the king speaks to the women of the palace. How you gaze upon Shulamith. How you look at her. Is that a dance of Mayhem, how you pronounce it? Is it, boy, she's a wonder to behold. And they were all happy. There was peace in the house again. Just as people, when you and your mate have a problem, there's no peace in the house. And your children know it. As I mentioned in a sermon before, when there's problems between you, your children sense it. And they know when something is not right. And they feel sad. And they can feel the disturbance in the forces, they say on Star Wars. Just as the other women of the palace knew something wasn't right. Happiness wasn't there in the palace anymore. And now they see her returning in Solomon's lead chariot by his side. And they know, they rejoice, they gaze at her, and they know that there's peace again. Solomon is back. They rejoice. And they're happy because Solomon and his bride are happy. What's the song, when you smile, the whole world smiles with you? Well, when your marriage is right, your whole family smiles with you. They're happy. It means an awful lot. And so the whole palace is rejoicing, just like at a dance. So it's great that they were able to be reconciled, and I hope that we can take note of that. And now their love, as a result of the problem, as a result of the leadership, what did I say earlier? I said the chauvinistic statement that a man can make of his woman what he wants her to be. He could have turned her off or on. He could have enraged her or inspired her. He made her what she was. He touched her. He loved her. And now, as a result of his leadership, that's why God says over and over in the Bible, husbands, love your wives more than he says, wives, love your husbands, because he knows that if the husband is right and he does his job, there will be not many problems that can't be solved. And the wife will be happy and be what she ought to be. But if the husband is remiss in his leadership or unskilled in it, and we all have to learn, then there are going to be problems, big problems. Yes, Solomon in the wedding procession in chapter 3, yes, he had the emphasis. He took the lead. The glory was lavished upon him because he was the most important figure. He was the key to the success of the family, of the marriage. And that same responsibility, husbands, lie upon us. We must also feed our flocks by the lilies. It didn't say by the rocks, it said by the lilies, denoting the tenderness. You know, you don't treat a lily rough. You don't treat a sheep rough. Yes, you must be firm with them. You've got to make them walk the path. But you treat them gently. You handle them gently. Do we husbands do that? How do we respond to our mates when they maybe have a problem? Do we respond in anger? Do we demand love? Or do we handle it gently? Do we use fire to fight fire? Or do we use water? Do we use love to put out fire? Now, you answer that question, and you learn from this, as I am learning from this. We all are. It's very, very important. So it's not only about sex and romance. It's about how to handle problems. It's showing that they were people, too, and they had problems. But they were problems that were able to be solved. With a little bit of patience, a little bit of tenderness. As the old song said, try a little tenderness. Okay? Well, let's go on a little bit here. As I said, I was going to say that as a result of this, they had matured. Now their love was a deeper love than it ever had been before. Now they're back together. Now we must go on here to chapter 7. A little bit of water here. How beautiful, chapter 7 here, are your feet in sandals. She praises him. No, wait a minute. The king is praising her. Let's get to that part here. I'm missing something here. Let's go here and check something. Just a moment, please. I want to check something in King James. Chapter 7. Okay, chapter 7, verse 1. This is him speaking. This is a king to his bride. After they've come back to the palace, everything's cooled off. Maybe this is sometime, some months later. In fact, I know that I have reason to believe that it's a full year later after the marriage. Now, how far after the problem is, I don't know. But here is a night to be much remembered in a sense of their love. How beautiful are your feet in sandals. Here again, he praises her. Look at him, always taking the initiative to be affectionate and to lavish her with praise. How beautiful are your feet in sandals. Even praising her feet, even the ones that she didn't want to get soiled to let him in, he now praises them. Oh, prince's daughter, the curves, and I want to say this before we get into the curves. You will find, as he describes her a year after marriage, you will find a more detailed, physical, and more sensual description. He praised her before for her eyes, yes, and for her pomegranate cheeks and temples. But now it gets a little bit more detailed because their love had matured. It had grown sexually. They had learned more about one another's body and how to satisfy one another. So we see a more sensual and physical description here on this night of lovemaking. He says, how beautiful are your feet in sandals. The curves of your thighs and hips, in addition to her thighs, are like ornaments. The work of your hands, of the hands of an artist. Or it says, I read that wrong, the work of the hands of an artist, her hips and her thighs were to him. Your navel is a rounded goblet, never lacking mixed wine. It was intoxicating. Her body, even her navel and her stomach was intoxicating to him, her midsection. Your abdomen, as I remember I told you about that sack of wheat, it was a stack of wheat. Your abdomen is a stack of wheat enclosed with lilies. Now, again, that wouldn't turn people on your wife today. Say, hey, baby, your stomach is like a stack of wheat, you know. Wheat checks and shredded wheat, you know, and all of that. That wouldn't turn them on, but that turned them on. Again, they lived in an agrarian society, and perhaps nothing was more beautiful to them to see a stack of wheat, you know. And again, as I said, he enjoyed the woman here physically. Your abdomen is a stack of wheat enclosed with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. In other words, again, they were intoxicating to him. They inspired him to want to play with them, to caress them, to touch them, and more than that, as we'll see in a moment. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. In other words, it was smooth, like ivory that is polished. How smooth it is, as he kissed her about the neck. Husbands, you should do these things beforehand. Smooth, in other words. Your eyes are like the pools of Heshbon. And this pool was a pool that was very inviting, a pool that everyone enjoyed imbibing in. And so her eyes were very inviting to him by the gate of a populous city. Your nose is like a tower in Lebanon, keeping watch over Damascus. Now, it wasn't that she had a big nose, but maybe she did. She was Jewish. But again, the character, the strong character that the nose projected. Your head crowns you as Carmel. And Carmel was a beautiful mountaintop, Mount Carmel. Sorry, she talks about how beautiful her head was. And the flowing locks of your head are like purple threads. In other words, her hair was royal. It purple is a color of royalty. And that's how he described her hair. The king is held captive by your tresses, by her hair, by her body. He was held captive by it. How beautiful and how pleasant you are. Love and your exquisite delights. This, your stature, is comparable to a palm tree. Not that she was as tall as a palm tree. But her breasts sort of
you know, was a sort of finishing touch of her body, and your breasts to its clusters. I will climb the palm tree. That is interesting. You don't climb a tree by starting at the top. You start at the bottom. And he probably began to kiss her feet, and her thighs, and her abdomen, and worked his way up to her breast. That's how he climbed the tree. He enjoyed her body. This is physical foreplay. And we know he always had the mental to go with it. I will climb the palm tree. And then when I get to the top, I will take hold of its stalks of fruit. Speaking of her breast. Oh, may your breast be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. Again, he compares their love to fine wine. And he said he's going to take the clusters of the vine. Well, you just don't take them and hold them. You put them in your mouth. And he said that he would put her breasts in his mouth. And this is very exciting to a woman. We'll talk about some of those things in the next Bible study. And again, they savored the love. He took his time. He took his time and savored it like a fine wine, very slowly. And lovemaking should be done slowly and gently. Take the time to love. My father used to tell me, if you're going to do something, do it right or leave it alone. And I think sometimes some wives would rather their husbands leave it alone if they're not going to do it right. Or never start something you're not going to finish. I think both of those terms would apply. But here we see a maturing love affair. And even maturing in their abilities to satisfy one another. Now she says to him, as their love, and she describes their love, going down smoothly for my beloved, flowing gently through the lips of the sleeping one. Here she is describing the end of love, the resolution phase. Remember I talked about the four phases of lovemaking, making the excitement phase, which involves mental foreplay as well as physical, and then the plateau phase, which involves the actual technique of intercourse. Then there is the climax phase. And then after that, there's a resolution phase. And here she's describing the resolution phase, where after the lovemaking, well, didn't Tom Jones or Engelbart, these songs keep popping in my mind, or Engelbart Humperdinck sing the song After the Loving? He was talking about the resolution phase, that you know, don't say, you know, bip, bam, thank you, ma'am, and go to bed. You still hold one another. You still talk to one another. You're still close to one another. She had the desire that he would lie between her breast all night, wake up in the morning with a crook in his neck. But nevertheless, you know, she was talking about that closeness even after the act, that they showed the tenderness and the love and the appreciation afterwards. And sometimes we neglect that. Oh, got to go to work in the morning. Let's go to bed. You know, just take the time. Do it right. Take the time to do it right. And she's commenting about that, going down smoothly for my beloved. You know, they have reached the plateau, the climax. Now they're going down the crescendo smoothly, slowly, flowing gently through the lips of the sleeping ones. Here they're describing sex, not necessarily always they had consummated the marriage. Now sex is used to feed the marriage, to nourish it. Why? It talked about wine in verse 3, about her navel as rounded as a goblet, never lacking wine in verse 3. Then it talks about wheat. And bread and wine are sort of staples of a diet, in a sense, especially for the French, I guess. As they say, a lot of alcoholics over there, too. But nevertheless, it talked about bread and wine and wheat. Wheat you make bread from. And what it's saying here, too, is that sex should be used to nourish, to feed a relationship. Sex is not an end in itself. If it was, it would just be an empty, selfish thing. But it is used in marriage to feed a relationship, to make it grow. To help it to mature, to help it ripen, to nourish it. So I just wanted to bring that out, some of the purposes of it. Now, I want to go on here. Verse 11. She says, I am, probably the next morning here, she says, I am my beloved's. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. She wakes up in the morning. She says, hey, I'm his, and he wants me. His desire is for me. And it reminds me of Genesis 3:16. Some take it as a curse, but it isn't. It's a blessing. God told the woman, and your desire shall be towards your husband. And that goes for the man. His desire should also be towards his wife. And that's why she says the next morning, and probably they both said, you know, boy, you know, wasn't that great last night? And I'm glad you're mine, and vice versa. And I'm glad you desire me, and I desire you. Just a beautiful relationship. They could communicate about one another. Now, let's go on to chapter 7 and verse 12. Here we see a scene, another scene of lovemaking, in the country. Perhaps they've taken their second honeymoon. Maybe their third. I don't know how long, but still in the early stages of marriage. They take their way to the summer cottage up north to the lake in the country here. And here we see a maturing relationship. The wife feeling more free all the time sexually. Verse 12, come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early to the vineyards. And nothing wrong with a little bit of loving, as the song said, early in the morning, as long as you make it to work. And this is what she's saying. Let us spend the night in the villages and let us rise early to the vineyards. And as I mentioned before in the last Bible study, sometimes vineyards is used to describe their bodies. Because she talked about, oh, that he would come into his vineyard. He was talking about, you know, her body. Boy, this is taking longer than I thought. We better hustle here a little faster. Let us see whether the vine has budded. She is saying, let's see if our love is maturing. Perhaps this was in the spring. Maybe a whole year, as I said, has passed. The winter is gone. Now it's spring again. And she says, let us see if the vine has budded. When she talks about the vine, she's talking about their love affair. Let's see if it's growing. Let's see if it has budded and its blossoms have opened and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. Again, when she says that, she said it two or three times before, talking about love. And now they're reaching a new plateau. There will I give my caresses to you. This is her speaking. She's saying, honey, she whispers in his ear. And she says a few sweet things to him. And she says, hey, I want to caress you. She says, I want to make you feel good. I want to please you. And women, as I said, it is not wrong. It is proper for you to be aggressive towards your husband sexually. She's telling him, look, there I'll give you my caresses, the ones that you particularly enjoy. And you ought to talk. We'll talk about that next week. You ought to let one another know. We talked about last Sabbath communications in marriage. We talked about verbal and emotional communications. There's also sexual communications. I find that couples are a little sometimes too embarrassed and too inhibited to tell one another what pleases them. To tell your mate where you would like to be touched and how. And she knew that. She knew what turned him on the most. And she says, hey, let's go to the country because there I'm going to caress you the way you like to be caressed. Verse 14. The mandrakes have given forth fragrance. Now, in ancient cultures, a mandrake was an aphrodisiac. It had, you know, sexual stimuli. It turned people on. Now, I don't know if that was true. I really don't. Somebody told me the other day, and I'm just kidding about this, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, that someone would think that I'm giving these series of sermons and Bible studies to increase the population of the church. Well, I'm not doing that, but I wouldn't be surprised that 9 months later from here we might have a bumper crop of little ones in the congregation. But anyway, she talked about the mandrakes, which were aphrodisiacs. Maybe we ought to have a series on birth control after this. The mandrakes have given forth their fragrance. It's a time of love. Everybody's stimulated. And over our doors are all choice fruits. That is, speaking under their clothes. over their doors, behind the door. He used to have a song, didn't he? What's behind a green door? Way back in the 50s. I remember all these songs. My father owns a jukebox company. And boy, I've been putting on records since I was 4 years old. And I know just about every one of them growing up. As I'm in restaurants and lounges and so forth. But anyway, and over our doors are all choice fruits, both new and old, which I have stored up for you, my beloved. New and old. What she's saying is, hey, we're going to make love in old and memorable ways, and we're going to be creative, and we're going to make love in some new ways as well. And that should be in any maturing sexual relationship between husband and wife. There are there are things that give you, that are old standby, the most stimulant. But then there are new things that also turn you on from time to time. And we should be creative as well as, traditional in our lovemaking. So she says, hey, we're going to, as we go behind the closed doors there, to all the choice fruits, both new and old, which I have stored up for you, my beloved. So let's go on now to chapter 8. This time is fleeting. Because here we're talking about a total relationship. No, that's about their sexual relationship, how it matured. Now I'm going to show you how their total relationship matured. Not only the eros, and not only the sex, how that matured and got better as time went on. And it should be. Is that fine wine? As it ages, it should get better. Now we're going to see that the other aspects of their love, how it matured. Here we're going to see, as she might would sing, you are the sunshine of my life. We're going to see all the lovely things that he was to her. In verse 1 of chapter 8, she speaks to him. She says, oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at the breast of my mother. Now, why does she say that? The rest of the phrase tells us, if I found you out of doors, I would kiss you, and no one would despise me either. What she is saying here, in their culture, it was sort of shunned upon for even married people to kiss in public. But if you were brothers and sisters, you could kiss. You know, affectionate, brotherly, sisterly kiss, and no one would say anything. So she says, I wish you were my little brother who nursed at my mother's breast. Then I would kiss you in public, and no one would say anything either. So that's why she wishes that. But she is also saying that, hey, you know, we've got a brother-sister relationship. We're close. We depend upon one another. We have a storge, as the Greeks say, love. A love of belonging. Your heart has a home in my heart, and my heart has a home in yours. We're close as brothers and sisters. We're friends. So it's a total relationship she's talking about. Verse 2, it's an irony here. She said, I would lead you. Not that she was trying to be the head of the house, but she says, I would lead you. I would bring you to the house of my mother. And you then there, or it says, you would instruct me. So it's an irony. In one part of the phrase, she says, I'd lead you to mom's house, but you would instruct me. So she looks at him, not only brother, sister, as a friend, but also as a teacher. And husbands, you ought to be a teacher to your wife, especially in lovemaking areas and spiritual areas. You ought to try to build your wife up, really. You ought to see that she becomes a total person, that she grows. Sometimes we're only concerned as men about our own growth and our own fulfillment. But we also ought to be concerned as to how our wives are growing. As intellectually, again, she's got a mind, probably, maybe, in many cases, sharper than yours. See that she grows intellectually. See that she's stimulated that way. Sexually. Spiritually. As well. So she desired him to teach her. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the nectar of my pomegranate. And this is saying, I'll be like the student, you be like the teacher, and I'll give you the apple. Like the student brings the apple and gives to the teacher. Verse 3. Oh, may his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. So she says, hey, he's my friend, he's my teacher, he's my provider. And finally again, He is my lover. Because she says, oh, that you take me and embrace me, your right hand and your left hand, embrace me with it. So here she sees him as in a total relationship, as a friend, a brother, a teacher. She's a student, brother-sister relationship, child, all in one. And your mate ought to mean all things to you. Really, all things to one another. Now, she speaks to the women of the palace, verse 4. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, not to arouse, not to awaken love till it pleases. She is saying here, love takes time. That all these things that she saw in her lover, of a brother-sister relationship, as a friend, as a teacher, it takes time to mature. She says, not to arise, don't awaken love till it pleases. Not only sexually, but in all these other areas, it takes time to reach this. And she's just passing down some advice to the girls who aren't married. So they didn't have this overnight. It took time. It should mature. It should grow. Okay. I've often said, you have love when you give it. I'd like to read something now from Shakespeare, from the play Romeo and Juliet. Even Shakespeare knew this. He said, my bounty is as boundless as the sea. My love is deep. The more I give it to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite. And that's so important to realize, that love is bountiful. But the more you give it, the more you have. Not the more you try to give it or get it. The more you try to get it, the less you're going to have. But the more you give it, the more you're going to have. Now let's see this now in verse 5 of chapter 8. We see here a portrait of their love. We see here a definition, as we'll see a little bit later on, of agape love. Remember we said agape love is a willful commitment for you to give to your mate without expecting love in return. They also had agape love, that commitment of a love. This maybe is God speaking. I'm not quite sure who to interpret verse 5 as speaking. But it's somebody looking at the two of them. And I'd like to think it's God. And they say, who is this coming from the wilderness? Who is this coming back from their honeymoon from the country? Leaning on her beloved. So here's a picture of them walking down a country lane. She's laying her head on her shoulder. He's embracing her, caressing one another in her second honeymoon. Then the bride speaks to the king. She speaks to her lover, and she says, beneath the apple tree. You remember we talked about that as they did in the last Bible study, beneath the apple tree, and how in all cultures it seems that an apple tree is a tree that is symbolic of love. You know, lovers will make the old heart on the apple tree and says, Solomon plus Shulamith equals love, and an arrow threw it on the apple tree. But she thinks back to that time in the country when they were courting, when they etched their initials in the apple tree. She thinks back and she says to them, she says, remember beneath the apple tree I awakened loved? Remember that's when we really fell in love, beneath the apple tree? When the time was right, she's talking about, and the circumstances right. There your mother was in labor with you. Now she's speaking in symbolism because she is saying here, like when you were born, Solomon, at a proper time our love awakened. At the proper time when we were ready, and the proper circumstances, we fell in love. Just as at the proper time you were born. And it was through labor. In other words, the longing, the sufferings that lovers go through, they experienced as well. We read in chapter 3 how she longed that night before the wedding. There she was in labor and gave you birth. So the pain, the insecurity of her being a country girl as she thinks back when she first came into the palace, the longing for her love to be filled, the conflict during the marriage as she thinks back, the pain. Put me, she says, I want to ever be stamped in your heart, and I want you to ever be stamped in mine. She says, put me as a seal upon your heart. Stamp me in your heart that I'll be there forever. Just as our initials will be forever on that apple tree, I want to be as your lover, as your friend, as your companion for life. And she says, put a seal upon your heart. Put me there as a seal. A seal, a brand that I belong to you and you belong to me. Put me as a seal upon your heart. And the heart is the source of affection. She said, I don't want our affection to ever die. I want to always be there, loved tenderly in your heart. As a seal upon your arm. She says, because love is strong, even as your arm is strong. For strong as death is love, as she describes her love in their relationship. Why does she say as strong as death? Because death is victorious over all. We're going to all die. And death conquers all. So she is saying that she wants her love, their love, to be as irreversible as death. And to last as long as death. No divorce. No leaving one another, but together for life. A true and longing and lifelong commitment. For strong as death is love, irreversible, so will that love be. Relentless as Sheol, or the grave, is jealousy. So she describes it to even more so than the grave is jealousy. In other words, she wants them to have a relentless concern for one another. Not a jealousy from where they're coming from, the point of view of being jealous because, you know, afraid someone else is going to take them or anything like that. But the right kind of jealousy, the kind of jealousy God has. God is jealous. He's a jealous God. Our jealousy comes from, well, is something being about to be taken away from me? God's jealousy is from the point of view of concern for the person's welfare, not because of his loss. Our jealousy is motivated out of a perceived idea of loss. God's is for the welfare of the other person. You should be jealous for your mate, but not because of a fear of losing them to someone else, but a jealous fear of not wanting to see them hurt, but to see only good come to them. She says, this kind of love that we have, it's flashes of fire. The flame of Yahweh, the flame of God, an eternal flame that can never be put out, that God stands behind. Like the sun is a flame of Yahweh. You know, you can't go up and throw a bucket of water on it and put it out. God put that sun there, and it's just, he sustains it. He says, she says, our love is like that, like the flame of Yahweh, ever burning. And flashes, its flashes are flashes of fire. It's intense, leaping flames. Like sunspots, you know, sunspots, big explosions on the sun. It's leaping, it's intense. Many waters, and here water is a type of problems that will and do come in marriage. Many waters cannot extinguish this love. No, not even waters, and even rivers of waters will not drown it. And you ought to pray that your love be that way, that no matter how big the problems look, even if they sometimes look to be as a flood that come to consume you, that that will never put out your love. If a man were to give all the possessions of his house to get for love, he would be utterly despised. She's saying, it's not something you can get. It is not something you can buy. It is something you have to give. All the money, all the trinkets, all the gadgets, all the physical things of life cannot be given to buy love. You have to give yourself in commitment to one another, in a commitment that can never be put out. That's a portrait of the kind of love they had. It wasn't just a sex thing. They had a deep commitment to one another. A deep commitment that nothing was going to separate them. Nothing was going to come between them and one another. Let's go on. Let's go on here to chapter, still in chapter 8 and verse 7. Which covers verse 7. Now 8. Let's look at how they first met. We've seen the romance. We've seen the sex. No violence yet. But we've seen some conflict. We've seen it resolved. We see a maturing, deepening love. We see a commitment. How did it all begin? Let's look back. And what kind of family did this girl come from? We know David's background. He was the son of David, and right and on it goes back to Abraham. In verse 8, it says, we have a little sister, and she has no breast. Here it's describing her. She's thinking back now. with her brothers and her family when maybe she was in puberty, maybe pre-puberty, maybe 10 or 11. And she had no breast yet. And the brothers said, "We have a little sister, and she has no breast." She flashes back in her mind. "What shall we do for our sister for the day on which she is spoken?" On the day someone wants to marry her, how will she be? Is the question. Verse 9. There are two possibilities of how she could be on the day she approaches marriage. If she is a wall, if she is hard and fast, if she is a bulwark against the advances of the fellows, against the propositions, against all of the lines that come, we will build on her a battlement of silver. In other words, we'll encourage her. We'll reinforce that behavior of saving herself because she's like a wall. Nobody enters. That's the kind of background she came from. That's the kind of teaching not only she got from her parents, but that's the kind of encouragement she got from her brothers to save herself, to be like a wall. And as I say to those parents that are here, please teach your children. Please encourage them to be like a wall, that nobody enters that garden, that they be like a fountain seal. It's so important to talk to your kids about these things. When they're even 5 and 6 years old, little Eric, 3-year-old, hey, we've talked to him about sex, about himself in the way that he can understand and how it's for marriage. Not only talking to him, but reinforcing him. Forcing it. Like Dr. Dobson said in a series about Christian fathering, that values, we do not teach our children our values, they catch them. We can be looking at TV. The other night we were looking at TV, some program, pretty good program. But they weren't married, and they kissed. Eric turned around and says, "That's no-no." We said, "That's right, Eric, that's no-no." Not only not no sex, but no kissing before marriage. He can understand that. And you've got to start with them small, that they be like a wall. It's too late when they're 16 years old to teach them this. You can do what you've got to do when they're at that age. But the most effective time is to instill, internalize these principles. And then, you know, they may mess up. But still, you got to teach them now. You got to do your part. They're going to have a lot better chance that way. You know, maybe we didn't have the opportunity because of not getting the right teaching to be like a wall, to be like a garden sealed, to be like a fountain sealed. But we sure can pass that down to our children. And she flashes back into her mind when she was a little girl and how her brothers encouraged her to be like a wall, how they reinforced that. We will build. See, they reinforced her character. We shall build on her a battlement of silver. She got that reinforcement from the home. That's why it wasn't just her standing on her own character. She had parents. She had brothers and sisters that backed her up, that supported her. And what a shame if we don't give that to our children, having knowing better here. Now, on the other hand, if she is a door and she swings in and out, and anybody who wants to comes in, if we notice she's going to take that. And children are different. Some are more, as Dobson said, some are more compliant. Some are a little bit hard-willed. And maybe she's a little fast and flirtatious. And we see that she's going to be like a door. We shall enclose her with planks of cedar. We'll put restrictions on her. If she doesn't have the character, and we can't use the carrot, we'll use the stick. See, if she doesn't have the character, we'll seal her up. We'll put restrictions on her, you know. We'll do everything we can until she can come to her senses. So just showing you the background she came from. And she's showing appreciation for her family and her brothers. Because what she was as a result of her family. What your kids are is going to be a result of what you are and what you do in your home. Now let's go to verse 10. I've got all kinds of notes written everywhere here. Verse 10 of chapter 8. Now she speaks to all. Maybe Solomon is there. She speaks to all the women of the palace. And she says, "I was a wall." She's not bragging, but she says, "I was a wall. I wasn't a door. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. She says, yes, I kept myself. I was a wall. I resisted the advances, but yet and still I was voluptuous. I developed into a voluptuous young woman, beautiful, well endowed, but I was like a wall, and I stayed off the temptation. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then, now she's matured, kept herself. Then she talks about the day they met. When I matured, was a wall there, I was working. Then I became, in his eyes, speaking of Solomon, as one who finds peace. Solomon's name means peace, so does Shulamith. And she found peace, she found favor in his eyes. He was caught by her appearance and her character as she worked in the fields. Verse 11. A vineyard belonged to Solomon. Now this vineyard speaks not of a body or her body or his, but of an actual vineyard, a physical field in the country. A vineyard that belonged to Solomon at Baal Hamon. This is where they met. He owned this vineyard and she was working. Her family were sort of like sharecroppers. It belonged to Solomon. He gave the vineyard to caretakers, which I derive and deduce to be her brothers. They're the ones who are supposed to take care of this. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. So while other girls were out playing and maybe on dates with the boys, her brothers stuck her on the farm and put her with the chores. And it reminds me of something. You know, God worked it out for the Shulamite, didn't he? He really did. She wasn't out pampering herself. When she was brought in the palace, she was scorched. She hadn't been pampered. But yet, God worked it out for her. She was down on the farm. And sometimes when we're single in the church, and I know I was like this, I thought, boys, nobody here for me to date. I'll never get married. But still, I kept myself. I knew God would work it out. God worked it out for the Shulamite. She wasn't the pampered little princess around the palace. She was a country girl. She didn't have the exposure to the fellows. She was working down on the farm, but God honored her character and her faith. And God found the right person for her because she was the right person. Single people, don't go around looking for the right person. Become the right person, and God will bless you with the right person. She was the right person. She became the right person. She grew, and God blessed her. So anyway, she was stuck on the farm. She says, my own vineyard. Now she speaks of her own body. That belongs to me. But I'm here working. I was out there working for Solomon in his field. My own vineyard belongs to me, her own person. The girl, the caretaker of the vineyard. She had brothers. And perhaps, you know, as she speaks now, she wants the king to realize that the brothers took care of her anyway, even though they stuck her on the farm. Now she speaks to the king. The 1,000 are for you. I've made your 1,000 shekels of silver. That's for you, O Solomon. And 200 for the caretakers of the fruit. Don't forget my brothers. Even though they weren't right and fair with me on the farm, they are part of the reason I am what I am. So give them some appreciation. Let's let a couple of hundred of the shekels or the shekels of silver go to the caretakers of the fruit. Now, in verse 13, we hear some of the final words. But this is not the conclusion, because their love had only begun, as the song said. We've only just begun. And we ought to look at our relationship that way, because we ought to grow. And here Solomon will speak, because he longs to grow. He longs to know more about her, to grow closer to her. And he says, O you who dwell in the gardens, hidden away in the gardens, there's much more there for me yet to discover. Companions are listening for your voice. In other words, my ears want to hear more about you. I want to know you deeper and better. Let me hear it. Remember before in chapter 2 and verse 14, he says, you're like a gentle dove whose voice has whispered out of the rocks, hidden. And he said, I want to hear the dove. I want to see it. Now he says, I want to hear you. I want to know you more. I want to know you deeper. I want our relationship to grow. Verse 14. He wanted to know more of the hidden person of her heart. Verse 14. She speaks now, hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And here Here again, she's speaking of her breast. And here again, she longs again for him to make love to her, for them to even increase their love, to grow in maturity emotionally, mentally, and sexually. She again longs for the intensity of lovemaking, that he be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. That is, as she described them, as frankincense and myrrh being her breasts. I want to conclude here with Proverbs 5, verse 18, from the New American Standard Version. It says, rejoice. I'm going to read it from the King James. Proverbs 5. In verse 18, it says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her be as a loving hind in a pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And that is how we ought to be, both husband to wife and wife to husband. That's how we ought to look at one another. That's how God wants us to love one another. Because our marriage, our romance, and our sex lives are very beautiful to God. And as God said in Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and all of your mind. I say we ought to love our mates mentally, emotionally, sexually, romantically, with agape love, with storge love, with all of the loves you can lavish with one another, to love one another with all of your soul, with all of your heart, and with all of your being. And God will call you blessed. Your children will call you blessed. And most of all, you will inherit eternal life. Because I said, I know it's directly tied together. God has called you into His church for salvation and called you to inherit it together. And even some of you who have mates who are not in the church or whatever, God still wants your marriage to be a beautiful experience, the most beautiful human experience that you can ever, ever enjoy. I've enjoyed going through this with you. I hope you've learned something. But more than hoping that you've learned something, I hope you will take these principles and use them. Else our time would have been in vain. Don't make it in vain. Make it very profitable. And love one another. And be blessed and happy in your marriages. So we'll see you next week. And we'll go into sex technique in marriage. I want you to read especially the chapters on anatomy in Mr. Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex. We will take questions next time about the Song of Solomon or about your sex life, you know, in general. I would appreciate, though, during the week, if you have them, think about them and write them up. I think it would probably be better, less embarrassing to you, if you would write them up on paper and not necessarily sign your name. So, look forward to seeing you on the Sabbath.